broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to the next episode of the Investor Exchange. I'm your host today, Louis van Copenhagen. Joining me on my left is Joel Hewish.
Good morning, Louis and listeners.
And Brett Dickinson on my right.
Louis, I feel for you, mate. You've been doing hosting duties for a while now.
I have. But that's okay. I don't mind being in the pilot seat.
Okay.
I've got to say, this morning, I'm flying.
I'm flying. Really? What have you taken?
Well, coffee is what I've had. I've had a coffee today, and I'm typically a 3-a-day coffee kind of person.
Right.
But I had an event last week where I had a bout of gastro, and so I couldn't really put anything in my body for a sort of 36 hours, which meant I went through all the caffeine withdrawals and the headaches and everything, and... not that I don't love coffee, but I just thought I'd go for a period without caffeine in my body and see what happens.
Now, Louis, so, we're up to roughly episode 50, I think, in our Investor Exchange podcast. I seem to recall something in the early stages of where you gave up coffee altogether.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And just because I like my brain to be functioning. And I find that if I don't have caffeine, then my brain actually functions in the morning before I've had coffee.
Really?
Yeah, that's right.
I find the opposite.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's a contrast.
Yeah.
It functions in some ways before I've had coffee,
but
it doesn't function in other ways. So it's interesting. Mm. But anyway, I've had a coffee this morning, so...
So you're flying.
High as a kite. Look out.
Here we go. That's right. Oh. I mean, it's better than other things that you could be on in the stereotypical share trading and boiler room environment.
Says who?
So I'm just going to flag on that topic. Just wait for something a little bit later in the episode.
Oh, okay.
Here we go.
Brett's always got something in store. So what's been happening in the world?
Wow.
Any new news happening in the world?
Well, we've always got this continuation of Trump and China fighting one another, but something that came out just this morning that I think our listeners might be interested in is the Rich 200 list. The AFR has just, and this is Friday we're recording this, so as of Friday the 31st of May, the Financial Review has now released their richest Australians.
Okay.
So let's go from 10 all the way down to 1. So at number 10, at $6.6 billion worth of net
that's not
worth,
much.
Is John Gandel,
the
owner of Chadstone Shopping Centre. Mm-hmm. Then at number 9, we have Ivan Glasenberg, at $7.17 billion. Now, he is the CEO and owner of Glencore, which is a major mining and resources trading business. Then we've got mining... guru at $7.99 billion, Andrew Forrest of Fortescue Metals. He ranks in at number 8. Frank Lowy, the Westfield tycoon.
Yes.
$8.56 billion, ranked at number 7. And then we've got the two guys from Atlassian.
Really?
$9.63 billion and $9.75 billion. Scott Farquhar, who's at number 5, and Mike Cannon-Brookes at number 6.
I wonder why there's a discrepancy between those two. I thought they owned the same amount of the company. Maybe there's personal assets that they've factored in on one party.
Perhaps. Mm. Maybe one of them paid a bit more for their mansions in Sydney. And it didn't go up in value as much. Who knows? Yeah. Maybe it was about a 16% decline in that property. Who knows?
Yes.
Who knows?
One got the westerly view, one got the eastly view.
Yeah, exactly.
Which one's worth more?
Maybe they paid too much for the bridge between their properties, so they hold hands and skip to one another's place. Then we've got property developer... Hui Wing Mao at number 4, $10.39 billion, but most of his property developments take place in Hong Kong. And then we've got number 3, Harry Triguboff, the Meriton tycoon, $13.54 billion. Gina Reinhardt at number two, $13.81 billion. And rounding out the top is Anthony Pratt and family.
And family, yeah.
The Visi board. Yeah. Well, former Visi board, but now they've...
they've expanded into
Yeah, the Visi board was split off into a number of different businesses when Dick Pratt passed away and different businesses were handed on to different family members to run. But he's now worth $15.57 billion.
A mere pittance.
Yeah.
Well, interestingly, in that list, though, there was a stalwart of the Australian top, you know, it used to be the BRW Rich 50 or whatever it was years ago, and the Packer name was always synonymous.
And that's true.
No longer real. Well, I'm sure it's in the 200 somewhere, but I saw an article yesterday that he sold off his last part of Crown, I believe.
Was it a last part, was it?
Yeah, or sold his half share.
Sold half a part. Half share. Yeah, okay, I think it was so $1.74 billion or something, or $1.7 something billion.
Yeah. Jeez.
I did see that, yeah.
So he must be in the billions, but he's not quite enough to make the top 10.
Yeah, that's right. Now, let's have a look at some quick stats. So by the numbers, the top 200 are worth a cumulative $341.8 billion. That's up around about $59 billion from the same time last year. Last year's total was worth $282 billion. We're up to $341 billion for the 200 people that are on there. The average wealth of the 200s, of the top 200, is $1.7 billion. The cutoff, so at the 200th level, is $472 million. So you've got to be worth at least $472 million to be considered in the top 200 wealthiest in Australia. Now, on top of that, where do you think most people are making their money?
Property.
Mining.
It is property, and it's property by a long way, actually. So about $80 billion is of the top richest people is generated through the property game. So property development, retail ownership, those types of things.
Well, and, you know, obviously the guy that's highest on the list with property was Trigubov. That Meriton brand with hotels has gone through the roof in the last 5 years.
Absolutely.
The volume of Meriton apartments around.
Yeah. Now, coming in at second is the resources sector, but it's down around sort of 52.6 billion dollars worth of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Coming in at number three is retail at $51.3 billion worth of wealth. But you can see that the property is well above all of those sectors. And then number four is technology, where there's $34.6 billion worth of wealth that has been created through the top 200 list.
Probably $33 billion of that is the Atlantis in two guys.
Yep. So that's now just another couple of stats. So we've got of the 200 richest people in Australia, 63 made their wealth in property, 29 made their wealth in retail, 20 in the resources game, 20 in investments, 19 in financial services, 14 in technology, and 13 in agriculture. Melbourne and Sydney tie for the most number of top 200, each having 62 people in the top 200.
All right.
Perth comes in at Southeast Queensland comes in at third at 21, and Perth comes in at fourth at 19. There are 29 women on the top 200 rich list this year.
Okay.
So, some interesting stats.
What the richest in the world, do we know who currently is?
It would be Bezos.
Bezos.
Yeah. Yep.
Actually, yeah, I've just looked it up. So, to compare, so our richest was the Pratts are valued at around 15 Australian billion.
Yes, that'd be Australian dollars.
So that's so probably
this is all in Australian dollars.
10 to 12 US.
Yeah, correct.
Geez, that's really poor compared to Bezos, who's got 152 billion as apparently his net worth at the moment.
Jeez. Wow, 152 billion.
Yeah. Billion. Well, this is on Wikipedia.
Yeah,
that's incredible.
Look at the list.
Who's number two and three?
Let me click on the list and have a look. Yeah, that's just the headline act. We'll see what the rest of the article says. So interesting. So, I mean, God, I kind of think once you get past, I don't know, 5, 10 million, haven't been there yet, so I don't know, but I can't imagine how much better the world could be, you know, how much more that money can do. But I mean, that sort of money in the hundreds of billions is just phenomenal. Mm. Okay, Bill Gates is second with a mere 90 billion.
A mere 90 billion. Yeah, of course.
a Frenchman is third. You guys...
Oh, that would be LVMH.
Yes, correct. Yeah, yeah, Bernard Arnault.
Arnault.
Then Warren Buffett. He's always been thereabouts.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
A Spanish in fifth, Amancio Ortega.
Oh, yeah, from Zara.
Yep. Zuckerberg at six.
Right.
Larry Ellison at seven. Oracle.
Oracle, yes. Yep.
Now, this guy was the... I remember looking at this list years ago and he was number one. Carlos Slim.
Yeah, the Mexican. Telco.
Mexican telco. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Michael Bloomberg at nine.
Uh-huh.
And rounding out the top 10 is an Indian, Mukesh Ambani.
Okay, what's
Reliance,
he do?
Reliance Industries.
Okay, right.
And look, as a footnote, the next two on the list, 11 and 12, are the two founders of Google, Larry and Sergey. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Lots of self-made people on that international list, whereas Australia's top two
family
inheritances.
Mm. Yeah. Initially from self-made people.
Initially from self-made, that's right. Second generation self-made.
Yeah. So they usually say that first generation makes it, second generation grows it, and the third generation blows it.
Right.
well, have a look at what's happened with the Packers.
It's been a bit that way.
Rupert Murdoch is the first. Keith Murdoch was the first one, wasn't he?
Mm.
And then Rupert took over as the second generation, and then you've got the children that don't get along anymore.
You don't really hear much of them these days,
the Murdoch children.
Oh, you hear about them in the background.
Okay.
Yeah. But it all sounds secretive. Not secretive, just private about who is really in control or making the decisions on various things.
Mm.
As for a public company, a lot of it is still very private.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm. And this year, 91 billionaires. So of the 200, 91 of them are actual billionaires.
In Australia.
In Australia. So I remember, you know, maybe 8-10 years ago, we'd be lucky if we had 8 billionaires.
Yeah.
And now we're up to 91. So
there you go.
That's a record. That is a record.
Next time you're walking down the CBD streets, you might just walk past a billionaire.
Well,
there's 62 of them in Melbourne.
Have a guess how many in Sydney. Have a guess how many worldwide.
I would guess maybe 2,500.
Oh, good guess.
Whoa.
2,153.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, well done, Joel.
Yeah, well,
aren't you good at curious? Aren't you good at forecasting? You're trying to get 2,101, aren't
exactly.
you, Joel?
Well, 2,103.
Well, and interestingly, the ratio of women on that list seems comparable to the Australian. 243 of those are women.
Right.
Which is what, sort of 8, probably 12%?
Yeah, which is about consistent with Australia as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now, there's always been debate as to whether Donald Trump is actually over a billion or under a billion. It depends on who you ask. but what do we think of Donald Trump? Joel, particularly, he seems to start these trade wars, but then he passes tax cuts. And is he a liability for the stock market, or is he a benefit to the stock market, or is it just it is what it is?
Ooh, good question, Louis. Well, I'll tell you what. Look, why don't we have a look at what's happened over the last, say, 5 weeks or so since the stock market has started to correct. So we've had this major rally off the lows of December 2018. We're now having another correction because Trump and China, we almost had a trade deal about a month ago. And then China at the last moment pulled out, believing that it was no longer a fair and equitable deal by slapping another $200 to $300 billion worth of tariffs on Chinese imported goods into the US. China retaliated by slapping about another $60 billion worth of tariffs on US goods.
Tit for tat.
And now China are perhaps upping the ante a little bit with a suggestion that they may restrict supply of rare earth minerals into the United States.
Ooh,
now, for
gotcha
those people
there.
Who aren't quite familiar with what a rare earth mineral is, all of those fancy high-tech devices that we use these days to have our smartphones and computers and all the electronics that go into cars and fridges and all of this, you know, these sensors and the things that are connecting this all together are these rare earth minerals are the key materials that go into running these high-powered electrical devices in miniaturization form. So this is no doubt some cause for concern, particularly for the US, and the market has sold off over the last 4 or 5 weeks as a result of this, particularly the US stock market more so than the Australian. The Australian stock market is actually doing pretty good, holding up quite well, probably because we're more tied into that strength in Asia rather than the fortunes of the US economy.
And are they, in doing that, are they looking to say, well, you can't make it yourself, so you'll have to buy our Huawei brand
that you're not liking at all? Yeah, potentially.
Because I know they put a black ban on Huawei products to some degree.
Yeah, so it's going to be interesting to watch how this plays out, because for a long time, a lot of people thought that the US held the strongest position. Because the US was a major importer of consumer goods, and as such, China was more reliant on the US buying their goods, that it would perhaps hurt China more so than the United States. Now, China do have some levers that they could pull. And the first one is obviously, you know, threatening to restrict supply of these important materials into critical components of electronic devices. The second one is the fact that the Chinese own a shitload of US debt.
They do.
And there is some suspicion that that the China, if this becomes a major dispute and it escalates to a point where, you know, a deal can't get done, that China could hit the nuclear option, which is selling all of that debt. And that would have the impact of depressing bond prices, pushing interest rates sky high, and it would pretty much sink the US economy into not just a recession, but a depression. On the flip side, though, they would also be damaging their own economy. Yeah. Okay, and we also know that the Chinese Communist Party they hold power today on the whole basis that their society remains stable and that there are enough employment opportunities within their country. Now, if they were to do that, it wouldn't just hurt the US, it would hurt the global economy, but it also hurt them pretty badly, and it could even undermine the power of the Communist Party. So while each has one lever over the other and another lever over the other, I'm more curious around the fact that and watching the fact that we now have elections that are coming up in November of next year, the presidential election. Now, what do we know about Trump and how he won the 2016 election? It was basically winning the Midwest states, the farming states, and those people Middle America.
Yep.
And right now, China is slapping tariffs on Middle America.
Right.
Now, I wonder that Mr. Strongman, Trump, who has been doing a lot of saber rattling lately, whether or not he can continue to hold that position where it is hurting his exact constituents that got him the election in 2016, and which he needs again to support him in order to have any hope of winning the 2020 election. So I'm just wondering how this all plays out over the next 6 months, 6 to 12 months. I think that both parties will be forced to back away from where their current position stands at this point in time. But I suspect that it's Trump's position that is being weakened the closer we get to 2020 elections.
Yep.
Not the Chinese.
Yep.
And so I wouldn't be surprised that even though there's been all this saber rattling, that at some point in time in the next 6 months, Trump will need to do a deal, show that the economy is improving off the back of this deal, and going into that 2020 election, being able to tout the good that he's achieved. Now, that has implications for the stock market, of course.
It does, because the stock market reacts to every piece of news.
Correct. So if we have that as some form of context or framework to work behind, and then we assess what's actually going on in the stock market, perhaps we can lay a case for the fact that good times still could be ahead for us. There's a lot of pessimism in the market at the moment, a lot of people worried and concerned. And if a trade deal does get done, all of a sudden the major overhang that's happening in the stock market at the moment could be removed. Now, if we go and have a look at what's actually happened from a technical perspective, we have seen through this rally that has taken place in December through to May, that the New York Stock Exchange advanced decline line, which is a measure of broad strength and participation in the rally, reached a new high, all-time high, on the 15th of February. Now, usually what happens is we look to see whether or not the breadth of participation in stock issuances rising with a stock market, with a stock index rising, both of them are following one another. And it's a good sign if both are hitting new highs, or the advanced decline line is hitting a new high prior to the price is hitting a new high. It tends to be a sign of underlying strength and a continuation of the bull market and a healthy stock market. And on the 15th of February, during this rally, we did see the New York Stock Exchange advanced decline line hit an all-time brand new high, leading the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ to new all-time highs, which 62 days later they did actually hit. So we have a healthy market.
Yeah.
While there is pessimism and there's a bit of a correction going on at this point in time, the underlying fundamentals and strength of how stocks are acting is actually pretty reasonable. And in light of a potential pressures to get a deal done in the next sort of 6 to 7 months, so that there is enough time to allow the economy to then sort of adjust to a trade deal and go into an election in a strong position. We have also the sound underlying technical strength in the market to allow for that type of rally to happen. So I think it's a mistake for investors to get too pessimistic at this stage. We could still be in this period where we've got a 5 or 6 month choppy environment, where maybe we oscillate between the highs and the lows of where we are right now for a number of months. But I think it is way too premature to be getting pessimistic. Corporate profits are still pretty reasonable in the US. Monetary policy is still pretty supportive, and interest rates aren't increasing. In fact, long-term bond yields in the US have actually come down. So funding costs and interest rate costs throughout the US economy are coming down as well. They're coming down here in Australia with probably a rate cut as well.
Mm. Yep.
So the monetary conditions are supportive. The tax and fiscal conditions and political conditions are relatively supportive, albeit we have this trade war that is an overhang on sentiment. The technical conditions are pretty supportive. If we get a trade deal done, we could see that this market later this year, early next year, could actually put in a pretty reasonable set of numbers.
So that trade deal, you're anticipating, given the timeline you've outlined, that they'll probably, well, Trump will almost be forced to have to reach agreement by the end of the year.
Well, I think
to give him the time he needs.
You would have to say it'd be almost political suicide not to try and get a deal done with, you know, 10 to 12 months worth of
election campaigning.
Yeah. Campaigning to go.
Yep.
Which, you know, the election's always first week of November, so that means by roughly the end of this year.
You would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Yep, for sure. Thank you, Joel. Very interesting insights. We'll take a break. We'll be right back.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Welcome back. I'm going to kick it over to Brett now. And Brett, I know you love looking at bottoms. You've been looking for bottoms this week, haven't you?
I have. Well, it seems to be a very popular game at the moment, especially after the... in light of the re-election of the coalition government. We're talking about the bottom of the property market here. One particular bottom.
That bottom.
Not multiple
okay.
bottoms.
I was about to ask.
And we're not looking for the shape. We're just looking for the time that bottom appears.
Confucius, man.
When the bottom finally bears itself. So, look, the general consensus is that with all of the perfect storm that's sort of gathering with the interest rate cuts likely, obviously the stability in what we know about property markets now that the government's been locked in, and also the Royal Commission being behind us, the expectation is that the property market's going to bottom out and recover in the short term rather than the long term. But of course, trying to pick that bottom, Louis, is a hard thing. So there's still going to be a bit of data washed through now that things are starting to normalise again. But the latest bit of data I thought I'd have a look at was from Capital Economics. So they're of the opinion that there'll still be another 3% fall across the country before it reaches its bottom.
Okay, right.
So they're saying we're at 10% now. They see the bottom as being at 13. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they're saying the current housing downturn, though, based on those figures, is larger than the previous 9 downturns we've had in the property market. Right. And that sounds right. I haven't got all the data in front of me, but I know they, you know, typically we don't have downturns of this significance. So their opinion is that across the country, houses are now pretty much fairly valued.
Right, fairly valued.
Yeah. Okay. So with that being the case, it's just like, as we sort of spoke about it last week or on the episode before, it's a matter of what's the catalyst, you know, what's going to start seeing more buyers and more sellers out there doing it, because volumes are still low compared to what they have been in the past in terms of actual sales transactions. And something I thought was a highlight of that, now this data predates the election, but it's still relevant. It's to do with lot prices, and it's only Melbourne data, but lot prices based on house and land packages. Mm-hmm. So when someone buys a house and land package, they're buying the land first, and they're buying a build contract at the same time. So the median lot price across Melbourne's sort of greenfield areas has been $325,000. And RPM, who are another sort of market researcher, they're expecting that will fall about another 5% before it hits the bottom. So too far away from the 3% that we're talking. And they said that there's a widespread view that lot prices are overvalued based on the falling values in the established housing market. So, of course, you know, if you're looking at buying, you're going to be looking, okay, well, if I can buy new for this and I can buy established for that, what's the better use of my money? And because property prices have declined, they're saying that lot values, they're still trying to get the same sales prices they have for the last 12 months, but obviously the market's not where it was 12 months ago. Mm. So they're saying that there's been a significant decline in the volume of new lots. The last quarter, so the March quarter, the lot sales were down 63% on their annual amount.
That's significant.
Yeah. Now, I would assume a lot of that is obviously, yes, we know there's a slowdown in the greater property market. Also, potentially being that because, you know, the election was coming, we know that a lot of people sit on their hands leading into that. So you'd expect the lower volume across all markets for that. But also, I would assume that as properties become more and more affordable, the people that might have been looking in some of those greenfield outer suburbs where, you know, if the lot price is 320 odd thousand, they're probably looking at a house build price of about $200,000 to $250,000, mm-hmm. so looking around that high five 600,000 mark, suddenly they can say, well, hang on, I can buy 5 kilometers closer for roughly that and get a property. So they're probably, you know, those buyers that would be looking at these types of properties are probably looking at existing property in slightly better locations because of the price depreciation or the price
something that was a greenfield area maybe 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, so, you know, this will turn as well. You know, obviously, one of the main reasons, too, that a lot of these lot prices aren't coming down is being offered at a lower price point is a lot of these developers that do sell high volumes of these have to be mindful that they've got settlements coming. Mm. So typically what happens when a settlement comes and people are getting finance, they get a valuation done. Now, if suddenly stuff is being released at 5 or 10% lower, a lot of those valuations are going to come in short, and the people that are needing to settle may not be able to get the full access to finance and be able to settle. Yeah. So there's a bit of a balancing act for these developers to obviously continue to incentivize the market with pricing or whatever else they can do to get the sales volumes they want, but also to make sure that they're not devaluing the property so that their existing sales can settle and maintain value.
Yeah.
So it's going to be an interesting period to see how this all plays out. The other part of the market it's affecting is the actual development site sales. So a lot of these developers that are owning these broadacre sites and subdividing them are now starting to look at saying, well, we need to now look at our forecast because volumes are slow and declining. We need to get longer terms and maybe better pricing on some of our broadacre sales. So there's, you know, changes in how a lot of these lots that were being sold quite regularly over the last few years in the outer suburbs are slowing down as well.
Okay.
Any bottom in the housing market that is going to take place is not going to happen just overnight. I mean, it takes time for people to come to the decision that they're going to actually sell. They probably want to see some evidence that prices have started to rise again and that transactions have started to increase. And it also takes time for people to actually get their properties prepared for sale, for, you know, do the garden. And we're in wintertime now, and, you know, people tend to have this idea that selling in spring is the best time to sell.
That's the consensus, yep.
So, yeah, so if we are going to see a recovery in the housing sector and in house price sales, it would make sense that it's going to not happen straight away just because the Morrison government got in and the Labor Party didn't. It would take time for that to feed into actually bringing these this stock onto the market.
And I think when you're looking for a bottom, quite often it's passed before you realise it.
Yeah.
I think the way the data and the way that, you know, the information comes about is we don't know we've reached the bottom until after we did it.
Yeah. Well, it makes me think of what are you actually trying to focus on here? Like, are you... If you're a listener who's waiting for the property market as a whole to tick upwards before you decide to invest again or invest for the first time, then you're probably waiting for the market as a whole to rise. All of these submarkets need to do their thing. So the greenfield sites need to do a certain thing, and that means typically the first home buyers or the low... low purchase price investor market needs to improve in a certain way. But that's different from another type of home buyer who's the upgrader in the more middle ring suburbs. That person's financial situation needs to improve for that part of the market to do better. So you for the whole market to increase, you're probably waiting for all these sub factors to line up in the right way. But that doesn't mean that there's not investment opportunities based on those sub markets right now.
Correct.
So it depends what you're focusing on. Are you looking for confidence in the market as a whole, or are you looking at your particular suburb, or are you looking for an investment opportunity, or are you looking for a home to live in?
I think the one thing I would look at with all of this information as well, if I was going to buy the market, I wasn't going to buy a particular property, I was just going to say, when should I buy the property market? I think the signals are that over the next... well, from now and for the next 6 months would be the ideal time to buy in if you were going to buy into a market as a you know, just the data of the market. Because I think it's going to, you know, the values will be hitting their bottom sometime in the next 3 to 6 months. And typically once they do, they start to increase from there on. So in order to be in the market at the right time, you would be doing it in the next 3 to 6 months.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Big question then, Brett. Is it going to be a smooth bottom or a rough, maybe hairy bottom, maybe a bottom with a crack in it?
Dimples. Now, why are you asking that question, Louis? Look, I can't see any reason why it wouldn't be anything but a smooth bottom.
Nice.
Freshly... oh, smooth as a baby's bottom, I would assume. No, I can't. There's no reason why we should have a bumpy ride, you know, and a lot of... you know, instability and volatility. You know, the market's pretty much been in decline for a long time. Everyone's aware of it. It's, you know, all of the financing settling, you know, the pricing settling. There's no reason that we should see too many bumps. It'll just smooth its way out.
Smooth its way out, yeah. Still a little bit of
might
crap.
Need a wipe or two.
Yeah, bit of crap to be wiped off before we get across that bottom.
Yeah.
All right, excellent. All right. Have we done that analogy to death?
I think we've done it.
I think we've done it. All right.
I think we need a break.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take a break. We'll be back with less bottoms after this.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
All right, we're coming back into it now.
Now that we've covered our bottoms.
Oh, we have.
Thank you.
All right, end of financial year topic number two. Just to bring it back to number twos.
Who loves end of financial year?
Oh, yes. Great time of year.
It's exhausting.
It is an exhausting time of year, yes. Yep. So last episode I talked about super contributions and how you can use those to maximise your end of financial year tax returns. One of the other things which was suggested in that episode and that I'll talk about today is bringing forward certain expenses that you're going to be paying anyway or should be paying anyway into this financial year. So if you've got a bill that you're paying monthly that you can typically claim as a tax deduction, you've got a bit of extra cash, maybe you can pay all of next year's premiums in advance, or maybe you can pay next year's interest on a loan in advance. I had a phone contract. This is a few financial years ago in my business. Mm-hmm. I had phone contracts on an ongoing basis where I was paying for the handset monthly, and I got the handset paid out in the last month of the financial year, so I didn't pay for the handset in the following year. So bringing those expenses forward to maximise your tax deductions. And I want to focus on one in particular, and that is income protection insurance. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I bring it up is because a lot of people don't yet have it, but commonly say they should have it. So if you've got something on your should have list, it might be time to put it on your get it now list. Mm. So for those who don't know, income protection insurance is a type of insurance that is there to replace your income if you have a health issue from a sickness or an accident. Mm-hmm. If there's a health reason that you can't go to your work because you've had an accident or because you're sick, then income protection will pay out a monthly amount to support your income while you can't earn an income from your job. So it's very important for those families who need monthly income to support their bills, to support their home loan, and to support their other commitments. Mm. And I would say 99% of families can't really go without monthly income. If they went for a six-month period of time with no income, they would be in a serious cash flow problem situation.
Without a doubt.
Oh, yeah.
See it everywhere.
Yep. So income protection is critically important for when something out of your control happens to your health. Mm. Accidents don't discriminate in who they choose to happen to. Illness doesn't discriminate either. No one chooses to get cancer or to have another type of illness.
Or break two wrists.
Well, yeah, no, thanks, Joel. From earlier this year.
Yeah.
So these things happen. So everyone should have it. So if you can get an income protection application in now, it's also a handy time of year to make your application, because insurance companies tend to be under a bit of, not pressure, but incentive to complete those cases before the end of the financial year. Typically, an insurance application can take between a couple of weeks to a couple of months, depending on how long it takes for them to get all their information together. Mm-hmm. An insurance assessor might just be able to push a marginal case through with a bit less information so that they can get the deal done by the end of the financial year, maybe hit a few targets, just a bit more incentive to get things done.
So opportunistic timing.
Yep. It is opportunistic timing to get income protection through. Mm-hmm. So firstly, do it for yourself to get yourself protected. Do it for yourself again to get your tax deduction for this financial year. And do it for the insurance company so they can hit their targets and you can help some other family get their end of financial year bonus and pay their mortgage.
Nice.
Hey, Louis, you've got me thinking with our discussion around real estate and knowing that sales agents are also living and dying by the commissions that they earn, would it also not be something that you could perhaps take advantage of in a negotiation where the agent may not be as willing to hold out for a higher price before the end of the financial year?
Oh, you could, absolutely. That's right. What I hear from real estate negotiators, and Brett, you can tell me if this is right or not, but they will use any deadline, whether it's real or imagined, to put a little bit of perceived pressure or incentive on the person they're buying the property from.
Well, they put the pressure on both. I mean, a lot of the time, the real estate agent's hardest task is getting the vendor to accept.
Yeah.
So quite often they use whatever tools they've got, because when you think about it, they're in a commission-based role where they only get paid once the transaction's absolutely committed.
Yeah.
So they're doing whatever they can to make that happen.
Yeah.
Whether it's end of month, end of financial year, end of the quarter, end of the calendar year.
And if they can get one to happen sooner rather than later, it means, great, that deal's done, I can move on to another.
I mean, we certainly find it with our client queries. There are definitely a lot of client queries that are genuinely, we need this done by the end of the financial year. Yeah. But a lot of client queries are perception. I want it done by the end of financial year. Just, I've had it on my to-do list for 6 months already. I just never told you to I never got around to contacting you about it. But now it's end of financial year and I'd like it done by then. It's a perceived deadline for a lot of people transactions.
I think even though it might sound, that's a bit underhanded putting these perceived deadlines, I think in a lot of instances it's necessary because a lot of people just don't act efficiently enough.
Yep.
And people, you know, if you are a buyer or a seller, you're in the market, you want to do it.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just need someone to be pushing you to actually finalise.
That's right. Yeah. Yep, exactly. And same with people's decisions to get insurance. They need a bit of an extra push. So again, today, I'm trying to use that as a bit of a push. Get your income protection insurance.
Yep.
End of financial year is a deadline. I'm using it to put a bit of pressure on you listeners. If you don't have your income protection insurance, go out and get it now.
Well, and it's pretty much, 4 weeks to the day?
As of recording, yep. 4 weeks now.
Right. Yep.
Yep. So not a lot of time. Get action happening and get onto it.
Very good.
All right, on to the next section.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious.
Thank you, Brett.
Pleasure.
All right, boys. What have we got today?
Have you ever had an instance where somebody has parked their car in your designated car park? Doesn't that just give you the shit?
Yes.
Well, I haven't had it occur, but I do see it.
You see it happening?
Yep.
My wife and I used to live in an area where we got a lot of football traffic and football parking,
right.
And people would just park across the garage.
I've seen people park across driveways, and you just think, that's ridiculous.
Yep.
Well, one Seattle man has taken exception to a car share vehicle that was parked without permission at his duplex. So what did he do? He built a fence around it and is now holding it at ransom to get that fence taken down.
That's better than one of those locks they put on the wheel sometimes.
Yeah, that's right.
Taking that a bit further.
Oh, wow. So Dan Smith has told a TV agency over in Seattle that whoever parked the car to go Mercedes on the 17th of May in his car park needs to pay him $60 a day, $65 a day for storage, $300 for the fence, and $500 just for being an asshole.
And the latter part being probably the most appropriate.
I'd like to see that itemized on an invoice.
Very good.
Jeez. There's a piece of legislation in Australia that enables parliamentarians to give free pieces of, call it Australiana, to constituents. Ooh. So if you're an athlete traveling overseas, you can request a free Australian flag or other pieces. So this bit of information went a little bit viral and a few trolls have used it. And the wonderful figure of the Queen is popular among some people. So politicians in Australia recently have been flooded with requests for painted portraits of Queen Elizabeth.
Right.
That is bizarre.
Parliamentarian quipped that they almost sent a picture of Beyonce instead.
Well, she's known as the Queen, isn't she? Up with the times.
Now, that could be applied multiple areas, couldn't it?
Guys, I don't have any experience with antiques, really, as an asset class. But I know quite often you hear of records being broken, of something being sold at a high price that you sort of think, wow, that's amazing, arts and antiques. And you think, well, quite often there's restoration of old pieces. You know, it might be equipment, furniture, something else. You know, there's the people that restore it to bring up the value for either the people that want to own it or potentially sell it.
Sure.
But sometimes the return for doing restoration work can be a bit varied. As Elliot Curtis found out. Now, Elliot was brought in to work on a rare synthesizer that was produced in around 1963.
Ooh.
And what he found was he came across a mysterious crystalline deposit stuck under one of its many knobs. And in wiping that off with his hands, he found that not long after, he found a strange tingling in his fingers that turned into a wild 9-hour acid trip.
Oh, yeah.
And it was verified that absolutely that crystalline deposit he was feeling was tested and proven to be LSD.
Wow. Oh, man.
So, somehow the drug had not decomposed after all of its time in the university storage rooms where it had been. And within 45 minutes, he was seriously and unexpectedly high.
Wow.
So he rode that out, returned to the workshop after his trip. to finish the restoration, but used gloves.
Sure he did.
Yeah, that's right. That's what right. He said. Carefully felt every under every other knob on the keyboard.
He brought his mates along to do some work.
That's right. Very good. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode. We'll be back again next week.
Thanks, Louis. Thanks, listeners.
Thanks, guys.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalised, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.